Good evening. It is so encouraging to see everyone out tonight, and I tell you, sitting up front, that singing, I think I'd just rather do that for a while. It's beautiful, and I appreciate y'all joining in to do that. There is a place in Scripture called Bethel, a term that means the house of God. And we often associate that with what went wrong in Israel when Jeroboam became king of the north and the kingdom divided between the Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And Jeroboam became king and he set up golden calves at Dan and Bethel and had people try to go there to worship. And of course, Amos uses it in a sense that shows the sins that were taking place at Bethel. And so we often associate it with that kind of the situation there. Jeroboam changed the worship, he changed the place, he changed the priesthood, and Bethel was a major factor in that apostasy, and so it tarnished what was originally meant for that to be. My focus here, though, is more on what it was meant to be, and I want to think about that a little bit. So let's back up a little bit to its origins. We start with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. We first hear of Bethel in Genesis 12 and verse 8 when Abraham first came to the land of the promise. He camped between Bethel and Ai and built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. And after going into the Negev, which is in the very southern region of Palestine, he came back to that same place, and it was here where there would be strife between the herdsmen of Abraham and Lot. And he offered Lot to go where he could wish, and so Lot went to the fertile land that later was Sodom in Genesis 13. But something important happened here between these two mentions of Bethel. Abraham did something, I believe, that was regretful. He had really come into this land that God had promised him, but then from there, there's a severe famine, and he ends up going down to Egypt. He was already in the southern region there in Negev. He goes down into Egypt, and there just seems to be no indication that that's what God asked him to do. And God made a promise, but the problem now is that where is that promise going to fit? What's the status of this promise? If the land is in question, if there's a famine, what's going to happen? And I would suggest to you, by the way, that in reading through these initial chapters of the Old Testament, that's one of the driving questions that I think is continually brought before us. What's the status of the promise? Because it seems like everywhere you turn, the status of the land promise, the status of the nation and seed promise, what's going to happen? Because people are doing wrong things, and it just seems like everywhere you turn, it's in question. So what's going to happen? Would Abraham trust God? I think is the driving question there. This time, maybe not so much. And if we fast forward, we see that Abraham would later reconcile God's promise with what appeared to be a threat of losing that promise again. When God asked Abraham to sacrifice the son of the promise in Genesis 22, Abraham did not waver. He knew God would provide. And God, of course, did provide. And so the promise was not in doubt in Abraham's mind by that point. In fact, what's so intriguing about by that point is that being asked to sacrifice his son, Hebrews 11 tells us that by faith he did this, and he's thinking in terms of the idea that if God actually had him die, he's going to raise him from the dead, which is remarkable given the situation, given the timing here. It's not like Abraham would have, you know, normally thought in terms of resurrection, or the people of the time would have thought that way, but he knew if God said, this is the son of promise, then he must have something in mind to bring him back because God meant what he said. So early on, Abraham went to Egypt to reconcile the problem. And in going down to Egypt, of course, it points out what would later happen to his own descendants. And recall that as Abraham was going to Egypt, he was concerned about what they might do with Sarai, his wife, who was a beautiful woman. And to avert that particular problem, he said, well, he didn't divulge the fact that she was his wife. Deceived the Pharaoh and created some difficulties because of that. Now, there was a partial truth. She's my sister. But he didn't divulge the whole thing. And it opened the door for problems to arise in that scenario. Pharaoh rebuked Abraham for that and sent him away. And it's possible It's possible that it was at this time that Hagar, known to be from Egypt, went along as the handmaiden with them. And that resulted, of course, later in another troubling situation that would create problems for Abraham. So a lot of cascading problems as a result, perhaps, of not trusting God initially like he should have. But one of the things you see in the book of Genesis is that things are driven by lies and deceit and lack of faith. Seems to be a signal problem in the book. People lie, but God is faithful. People deceive, but God is faithful. People are faithless, but God is always faithful. And that occurs over and over again. So Abraham came back into the land and went back to the spot at Bethel, or at the time Luz, where once again he calls on the name of the Lord in Genesis 13 and verse 4. It was as though he lost his way for a brief time, but came back to the place that reminded him of how important the covenant was. Abraham was by no means perfect, but he came back to the altar. He came back to Bethel. He came back to the covenant. He came back to the promise. And his is truly an example of faith. Now, technically, at the time, this wasn't called Bethel just yet. We're going to get to that because it hadn't been named that yet, but it's the same place. And as we see, the name Bethel is going to be given by Jacob. So how does that happen? So now we turn over to Genesis 28 and the situation with Jacob. So we think of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the promise that's associated with them. God promises, I'm going to give you this land, I'm going to make a nation of you, and there's going to be this seed promise that ultimately we know is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. These are the names we're familiar with. Isaac was Abraham's son of promise, specifically called the son of promise, and Jacob was one of the twins born to Isaac and Rebekah. So through twists of deceit, through twists of manipulation, Jacob is going to be the one through whom the seed promise would proceed. And I do think it's interesting to note here how God uses flawed people to carry out his will. He uses flawed people to bring about the promises. And that's why I say there are times you're looking at that wondering, what's the status of the promise? Because it seems like everywhere you turn, people are going the wrong direction, doing the wrong thing, lying, deceiving. What's the status of the promise? God is still going to use them to carry out his will. Isaac was intending to give the firstborn blessing to Esau, you remember, and Esau had already given up his birthright to Jacob, but now the blessing is in Jacob's sights as well, and so he's going to manipulate the situation to bring about the blessing promised to him. And you know, Rebekah loved Jacob more than Esau, and she counseled Jacob to cook a meal and dress like Esau and go in before Isaac, and because Isaac couldn't see. And so, you know, Isaac says, well, you know, he's looks, it feels and smells like Esau, but he kind of sounds like Jacob. But he goes ahead and gives him the blessing. And so again, through deceit, that's what happened. So it worked. But because of the threat of Esau, now Esau angry at Jacob, I'm going to kill him. Jacob is guided to leave the land of promise and go to where Rebekah had come from. He did, of course. But on the way, a few things are going to happen. Now again, what's going to be the status of the promise, you see? Because now the one through whom the seed is going to come is leaving the land. What's going to happen? How's this promise going to be fulfilled? As Jacob was traveling north from Beersheba, which is way in the south of Judah, he came to a place to rest in Genesis 28, took a stone, laid his head on it, and then he dreamed. And I'm going to read from Genesis 28, beginning in verse 12. And he dreamed. And behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And in the morning, Jacob took the stone, set it up as a pillar, poured oil on it, and called on the name of that place, Bethel. The name of the city was Luz at the first. Notice that this is the same general area where Abraham had been, his grandfather had been, had made the altar there. We don't know whether the altar was still there or not, whether he would have seen that or not. But now this place becomes important once again. It's a place of covenant. It's a place of promise. Jacob made a vow that upon his return to this place, the house of God, he would serve God. Well, unfortunately, it would be a couple of decades before Jacob would return and remember what had happened there. The text actually tells us that the sun had set, and he goes through his own period of darkness when this happens. So Jacob went to the home of Laban, his mother's brother, and there he met the woman that he would fall in love with named Rachel. Due to deceit from Laban, and again, deceit is driving some of these stories, Jacob first marries Leah, Rachel's older sister, and then he marries Rachel, all the while serving Laban for a number of years. Time passes and Jacob begins to have children. It became apparent that Jacob would need to take his family and leave, of course. And the Lord told Jacob in Genesis 31 and verse 3, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you." So the focus is again on the land. Go back to the land that you left, because that's where I'm going to be with you. And Jacob relayed this dream to Rachel and Leah, told them what the Lord had said. "I am the God of Bethel," he says, "where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred." Genesis 31 and verse 13. But notice what he says, "I am the God of Bethel." Now through some difficulty and more deception, they left the home of Laban and went back toward Palestine, to the land. Jacob knew this was going to be a difficulty, though, because he was going to have to face Esau again. And as he neared where they would meet, Jacob tried to send gifts ahead, you might recall. Let me try to appease the situation. Maybe he won't be so angry, and he's sending gifts ahead and trying to get Esau to lighten up. He didn't know how Esau would respond. But before that meeting between Jacob and Esau took place, an even greater meeting occurred. As Jacob stayed in his camp one night, Genesis 32, 24 says, "A man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day." Well, let's think about this for just a moment. What I like to just think of as dislocated hips and blessings. Genesis 32 tells this really intriguing account of Jacob wrestling with a character who at first seems pretty mysterious. The text says, "A man wrestled with him until daybreak." A man wrestled with him. Hosea 12 and verse 4 calls him an angel or a messenger of some kind. But when this man saw that he had not prevailed against Jacob, verse 25 says, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Adding to the mystery, we further learn that when this wrestling match was over, the man was more than a man. What Jacob realized was that he had, in fact, been somehow striving with God. And that's where this can really get confusing. How can Jacob strive against God and prevail? After all, he was told in verse 28, "You have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." How can this be? Does this in some way diminish the power of God? Was not God still all powerful? Well, did Jacob really beat God in a wrestling match? Did God really not know the name of Jacob in verse 26? There's more going on to this. And I think one of the keys of this text is that Jacob asks for a blessing from his opponent. Jacob, this is verse 26, he holds on to the man that he's wrestling with, insisting that, "I'm not going to let go until you bless me." That tells us something important, because we know that the lesser is blessed by the greater. And Jacob knows this man is greater somehow. He recognized that he was greater and that this man had the power to bless him. And notice also how Jacob responds to the entire situation in verse 30. I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. In other words, Jacob knew that he was really dealing with God and that the only reason he prevailed was that God let him prevail. As a testimony to the occasion, the dislocated hip, along with a pronounced limp, reminded Jacob that this happened for the rest of his life. This would be a reminder. No one prevails against God unless God permits it, and God allowing this to happen was itself a tremendous blessing. But even that sounds kind of odd to say that God allowed someone to prevail against him. Why would God allow anyone to prevail against him? It would seem that we need to understand the idea of prevailing in somewhat of an accommodative way, because as we know, no one can actually defeat God in any kind of permanent sense or absolute sense. So why do we see Jacob winning here? What's going on? The answer, I believe, that suffices is that God was teaching Jacob some significant life lessons here. After all, God isn't the one who left the event with a limp. And surely he would have dislocated much more than Jacob's body if he wanted to. But as the day was dawning and these events were taking place, God wanted something more important to finally dawn in the mind of Jacob. As we saw, he entered a period of darkness when the sun had set. He comes back into the land and now the sun rises, and it's going to rise in his heart as well. Verse 31 says, now the sun rose upon him, just as he crossed over Penuel and he was limping on his thigh. And now he's coming back to the land and he's remembering the covenant that God had made with him all those years ago back in Genesis 28, 20 through 22. The point here is that Jacob prevailed because he finally got it. He finally understood. After about 20 years outside the promised land, he came back and he finally began to realize what that promise to Abraham was all about in Genesis 39, 9 through 12. He finally prevailed because he quit fighting against the will of God. He kept fighting against the promises and he accepted what God had in mind for him all along. So really, his victory was not over God, but with God. Jacob's tenacity in pursuing the blessing from God would finally come to fruition. Jacob prevailed when he gave himself over to the blessings of God. And this event would be a continual reminder of Jacob's struggle with God. And yet this is also when his name was changed to Israel, which one of the meanings of that is striving with God, which is something the entire nation would continue to do throughout their existence. What about us? Do we ever find ourselves essentially wrestling with God? There are a couple ways to take that. We might be wrestling with God without really trying to seek his favor. Our fighting against God in that sense would be like Jesus said to Saul, why are you kicking against the goads? It's hard for you to do that. But for Saul to be blessed in Acts 9, he had to give up his former ways and turn to the Lord. He had to quit fighting against God. If we find ourselves fighting against God in that sense, we're going to have to repent, turn around, and quit that fight. But we can also see this in the sense of persistence. There will be times when, due to our persistence, God will give the desires of our prayers and recognize that what we pray for is according to his will and with the right motives. But as we seek the Lord, I believe, like Jacob, the sun will rise with us and we'll learn even more what it means to serve him and to receive his blessings. And there may be painful reminders of our struggles. We may come away with some permanent limps, but we'll be blessed by God. So as the sun rose physically, the sun rose spiritually for Jacob. He left the land and now he comes back. And his reunion with Esau, as you know, went well. The concerns were there. What would Esau do? Was he still angry? Was he still going to try to kill Jacob? But when Esau saw him, they embraced, and it was well. And he came to Shechem, where he built an altar there, but it wasn't over yet. Genesis 35 in verse 1, God told Jacob, Genesis 35 and verse 1, God told Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." Jacob told his family at this point to put away the foreign gods, to purify themselves, and to change their garments. Then he said in verse 3 of Genesis 35, "Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone." So God watched over them as they traveled. Jacob arrived, set up a stone pillar, poured out a drink offering and oil on it, and once again it says, verse 15, he called the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Bethel. The covenant first given to Abraham is renewed, and Jacob is renewed. So notice the basic connections here between Abraham and Jacob. They both left the land under very difficult circumstances, situations in which they could have displayed greater faith than what they did. They were both involved in forms of deception, and this only got both of them into more trouble. But even so, they were still blessed. And then they both came back to the land wherein God renewed the covenant with them. And the place they both came to was Bethel, the house of God. Again, through the unfaithfulness of flawed people, God was still faithful to the covenant promises. He was not going to waver in his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Bethel stands for covenant renewal. It's the house of God, the place where God meets those who return to him. And we are begging people today to come to Bethel. But to do that, we look to Jesus. So to see the greater application for God's people now, we go back to Genesis 28, 12 through 17. And once again, the vision that Jacob had. Recall that in this dream, he saw a ladder, and at the top of it, it was ascending into the heavens. The Lord stood above it. God identified himself as the God of Abraham and Isaac, telling Jacob that the land would be given to him and to his descendants. That seed promise, that through the descendants, his descendants, all the families of the earth would be blessed, is also reiterated. So God would watch over Jacob, and the promise would come about, and God would be faithful. So again, that's the vision, that's the dream, that's what God promises, and so this is about the covenant. Jacob knew this place was special, and it was called the house of God and the gate of heaven. So let's fast forward to Jesus in John chapter 1. Because Jesus is the fulfillment of the seed promise, as we know. But what is the connection between Jesus and what happened with Jacob at Bethel? So listen to Jesus in John chapter 1. Jesus came to Galilee, and you recall the situation where Philip finds Nathanael. And Jesus said to him, Philip said to Nathanael, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Which is always interesting to me. You see, I'm from California, and I've heard that question a number of times about California. So I still don't know the answer to that, but there it is. "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said, "Come and see." John 1, 45 and 46. In verse 47, as they came to Jesus, Jesus tells Nathanael that he had seen him in whom there is no deceit. I find that intriguing because it's in direct contrast to what we've been seeing in Genesis. Lies and deceit. And here comes somebody that Jesus says, here's somebody in whom there is no deceit. Nathanael responded, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus says, "I've seen you under the fig tree. There's no deceit. I know who you are." And Nathanael's response is, "You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Nathanael realized at that moment that the Lord had come. Now, here's what I want you to see, the connections to something in Zephaniah. We don't often make connections in Zephaniah. But follow this. Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 12. Zephaniah 3 and verse 12 says, "I will leave you in your midst a people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord. Those who are left in Israel, they shall do no injustice and speak no lies, nor shall there be found in their mouth a deceitful tongue. For they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid." Okay, so you see the connection there, first of all. What the Lord is looking for here, those who seek refuge in the name of the Lord, they do no injustice, they speak no lies, there's no deceit found in their mouth. What did Jesus say to Nathanael? There's no deceit found in him. So Nathanael was just identified that way. Here's one in whom there's no deceit, which does, again, stand in contrast to what was happening in Genesis. Then Nathanael's response, "Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Notice in Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 15. "The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He's cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall never again fear evil." Nathanael, a man in whom there is no deceit, is putting together the pieces of the puzzle, and he knew the king was in their midst. Something Zephaniah had prophesied. I find that intriguing. Jesus, the divine Son of Man, from Daniel chapter 7. You know, we think about the various titles that Jesus takes, and each one has their special meaning. But I'm intrigued by his usage of Son of Man so often. Because, now Nathanael said he's the Son of God, but Jesus usually calls himself the Son of Man. But that's more than just being human. It includes that, but it's more than that. Because it connects to Daniel chapter 7, 13 and 14, where the Son of Man figure goes before the Ancient of Days and receives the authority, power, dominion, and kingdom. He's the king. He's the divine king of Israel. The prophets pointed to him. But there's more. So we go back to John 1, 50 and 51. So this is, again, after Jesus says this is one in whom there is no deceit. Nathanael says the king of Israel is in our midst, which is, again, what Zephaniah talks about. And then Jesus responds to him in verse 50, "Truly I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." So now he's calling himself the Son of Man, tying it back to Daniel 7. You'll see the angels of God ascending and descending. How shall we understand John 1:51 about the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man? The heavens are said to be opened at his baptism. In Matthew chapter 3, 13 through 17, the heavens are open, the Spirit comes down, and the Spirit descends and rests on him. And a voice came from heaven and said, "This is my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased." And we could also point to the heavens being opened in connection with Jesus when Stephen, about to die, saw Jesus, the Son of Man, standing at the right hand of God in Acts chapter 7, 56. Or we might think of Jesus in the garden before his death when the angels ministered to him in Luke 22 and verse 43. So there are occasions where, as it were, the heavens are opened up on Jesus. But these passages do not fully explain John 1:51. And we find no other event in Jesus' life that we read about coinciding with angels of God ascending and descending upon him. And I believe we're really left with one viable alternative and this important connection. Jacob's vision in Genesis 28 is the key. The key components of Jacob's vision helps us see the importance of Jesus' statement in John chapter 1. The ladder reaching from earth to heaven depicts access to God. As the heavens are open to confer blessings, the ladder is used in both directions. God's messengers both descend and ascend this ladder. God sends his message to earth, and his message invites us back to heaven. But God is ever in control of this. There are his messengers, but he controls the access as well as the blessings. And what the ladder depicted is exactly what Jesus has done and exactly what Jesus enables. He came down, he descended to confer blessings and invite us back to heaven with him. And the covenant context of Genesis 28 is also significant. God renewed the covenant to Abraham with Jacob, including the critical promise in verse 14 of Genesis 28, "In you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed." What's the real blessing here? Indeed, the greatest blessing conferred by God out of heaven is this promise. The promise Peter points to in Acts chapter 3, 25 and 26, as he preaches his sermon there. "You are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant God made with your fathers, saying to Abraham, 'And in your offspring all the families of the earth shall be blessed.' God, having raised up his servant, sent him to you first to bless you by turning every one of you from your wickedness." God sent Jesus to bless us, to confer blessings upon us, and to bring us back to heaven with him. In other words, what the ladder represented in the dream is exactly what Jesus fulfills. How can we have that great blessing? We can't reach up into heaven. And every time people try to do that kind of thing, it results in disastrous circumstances. So, for example, what are they doing in Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel but trying to reach up into heaven their own way, making their own path, and God comes down and confuses them? I kind of see that as typical of what happens with basic religions today. We seek our own path. We seek our own way. We try to find ways up to heaven, but we can't do it. But God came down again in Jesus, this time to reverse the curse and to provide the blessings. But I can't reach up into heaven to make salvation happen like that. In fact, that's part of the point. Romans chapter 10 and verse 6, the righteousness based on faith says, "Do not say in your heart, 'Who will ascend into heaven?' That is to bring Christ down, or 'Who will descend into the abyss?' That is to bring Christ up from the dead." Who can do that? I can't do that. We can't build a tower to do that. But Jesus did just that. He descended, died, was raised, and then ascended, and that's what made salvation possible. God opens up heaven by sending Jesus for this very purpose. And by means of Jesus' death on the cross, the shedding of his blood, and the resurrection, God opens up the heavens in the greatest of senses. So listen to the Hebrews writer in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 11. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 11. "When Christ appeared as high priest to the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy place, not by means of blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing eternal redemption." Dropping down to verse 24 in Hebrews 9, "Christ has entered not into the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place every year with blood not his own, for then he would have to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he's appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." God be praised for what Jesus has done. We have no access to heaven without him. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me, Jesus says. He is the access into heaven. He is the gate of God. So Jesus basically is using the language of Genesis 28 to describe to Nathanael the greater things that he would see. Because it shows us that Jesus is the ultimate answer to Jacob's vision. He's the fulfillment of that promise. He's the completion of Bethel. He is the completion of the house of God. Which I would even draw out an application even further to think about that in connection to what would be the temple later. God's very presence among men. And isn't it interesting then when Jesus comes, John 1 and verse 14 says, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." When you see Jesus, you see the temple of God. You see the house of God. You see the presence of God in the flesh. And Jesus came to give us access back into heaven. Because our sins and through our sins, we lost that access. He's the ladder. He's the means of God bestowing the greatest blessing, the greater things of forgiveness, so that fellowship can be restored, redemption can be procured, and we can share in the glory of heaven, the new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. That through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, God has indeed opened up heavens in the most profound of ways. Just think about that. God saying to us, "I'm inviting you to participate in heaven itself." The blood of the cross has opened up the way. The resurrection has made it possible for us to ascend. Because Jesus descended and ascended, we too can ascend to be with him. To come home to Bethel in the truest of senses. Jacob's response to the vision was significant. He set up a stone as a pillar, called the place Bethel, and again recognized that this is the gate of heaven. For us, God has set Jesus as the cornerstone upon which we are built as living stones in the spiritual house of God. 1 Peter 2 tells us, when we look at the cross, we partake of the body and blood of our Lord. We want to see the memorial of the gate of heaven which God lovingly opened on our behalf. We're going to sing a song in just a moment. What I'm encouraging you to do tonight is think about the covenant with God. Think about the promise of God. Think about how God has fulfilled those promises and think about how God has invited you back to heaven with him. Because if you've left the land, then come home to Bethel. Come back to the house of God. If you find yourself wrestling with God, let your dislocated hip cause you to remember his message. Come back to the promise. Come back to forgiveness. Come back to the land and live your life in a way that glorifies the one who gave himself and opened up that access to God himself, to the Holy of Holies, in the very presence of God. What a great promise we have to share in the promises that were first given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because ultimately it wasn't about the land, it was about the seed. And Jesus is the fulfillment of that. We're going to stand and sing here in just a moment. Think about your relationship with God. I would urge you, I would beg you not to walk out of this building tonight uncertain of where you stand before him. Let's stand and sing.